Well, it's a small remnant this morning. Okay, well, we last time in our review we left off with the good Earl of Moray, the good regent, having been assassinated by one of the Hamilton family. His death led to 3 years of civil war, not so much to avenge his death as there was a vacuum in leadership. Also, there were a number of tensions left over from Mary being in England. There was this arose a king's party and a queen's party. Mary wasn't judged guilty of the murder of Darnley, but she was still in prison. She remained in sort of limbo for a number of years before she was executed. So the king's party represented more or less the continuation of Moray's policies. They were, by and large, the lords of the congregation, the Protestant lords. There were a few exceptions, Kirkcaldy of Grange being one. The Queen's Party, Kirkcaldy was part of the Queen's Party. In fact, he eventually got captured and was hung. John Knox even went and tried to talk some sense into him, but they didn't come to terms. So. Well, let's see. The Queen's Party held Edinburgh Castle, Edinburgh, Dunbarton Castle, and the King's Party of much of the rest of the country, and there was this struggle between the two. In July 1570, Lennox, who was Darnley's father, was appointed regent. This was helpful for the good relations between the King's Party and Elizabeth, but it exacerbated the feud between the King's Party and the Hamiltons, who were part of the Queen's Party. Let's see, in April 1571, Dunbarton Castle was captured by the King's Party. In 1571, George Buchanan published his book, The Detection of the Doings of Mary, Queen of Scots, touching the murder of her husband and her conspiracy, adultery, and pretended marriage with the Earl of Bothwell. It was written in Latin, but with a scholarly, quote, attention to detail and a poet's gift for vivid phrase, does it create a sensation, was cumulatively horrifying. This further weakened the Queen's Party. In September 1571, soldiers of the Queen's Party, led by Claude Hamilton, tried to capture a number of the lords of the King's Party in Stirling. When some defending troops arrived, they fled, but they killed the Earl of Lennox, who was one of the three of the four, he was one of the three regents who died for James and his minority that died of unnatural causes. Let's see, John Erskine, the Earl of Mar, was appointed regent in his place. Okay, and then at this point we start to see some further division of the, or turmoil in the church. And this is the controversy over bishops, some of the artifacts of the Catholic establishment. The holders of some of the benefices died. Some of the nobility were conniving to obtain their benefices, right? And that's the income from property, rental, and tithes, right? And their basic scheme was to appoint someone in their place who would agree to give most of the money to the lord who appointed them. So then this was further complicated and intertwined with the parliament, in that the archbishops had a seat in the parliament. It was not really unclear who they represented before they had represented the church. But if they weren't even appointed by the church or had any close ties to it, who did they really represent? At Parliament in August of 1571, the Earl of Morton attempted to seat a replacement for Archbishop Hamilton in Parliament, and the church objected, since they hadn't examined the nominee. That's why they objected. But furthermore, they didn't have any, in their new form of church government, they didn't have any archbishops. So it was also a bit of a fish out of water, so to speak. The regent then appointed a committee to examine the issue. With some ministers and some nobles, it was weighted by those who wanted to maintain a system of archbishops and benefices. And they reached this compromise solution, it's called the Life Concordant, on the 16th of January, 1572. And it wasn't a very favorable compromise to the church that maintained the office of bishop. These bishops were commonly called, I guess it's Tulchin, I've never quite figured this out, Tulchin bishops. A tulchan is a calf skin stuffed with straw to cause the cow to give milk. For the Lord's got the benefices and presented such a man as would be content with the least commodity and set the rest in fews, tax, pensions to them or theirs. Now that's Calderwood, a contemporary historian. So in other words, you wave the little guy that you hire up in front to get the money, and then you keep all the money. So let's see. In August of 1572, there was a Protestant massacre, the massacre of St. Bartholomew in Paris, and that this is one of the themes, are these Catholic scares that keep coming up, and this is, you know, these things that are happening in France feed this. Okay, Knox was dying by the fall of 1572. I think I told you last time, knowing he was near his end, he opened a new hogshead of wine and encouraged his guests to drink heartily, as he knew that, told them that he wouldn't be there to finish it. And he died on the 26th of November, 1572, and he was buried in the St. Giles Churchyard, right? And that's reportedly now a parking lot. We tried to get the guard when we were there to tell us which car it was under, but I don't know if he either didn't know or was just a bit vague on it. He said, what difference does it make? It's under a car up there. Well, that's a good question. He was either... I guess there's two theories on his age, and I think his birthday, if I remember right, they're 10 years apart. That's the question is, was he born either in 1505 or 1515? And if I remember right, I think it was generally thought to be 1505 until early in the 20th century, when somebody theorized that some mistake had been made in translating some, you know, or transcribing something that was really 1515. I think it's hard to say for sure. So some people think he was born later. More recently, somebody that I read said that his description at his age when he gets near his death is more consistent with having been born in 1505. So if he was born in 1505, he would have been what, 67, something like that. So I don't really know. 57 or 67, I guess. So, just a little bit more about Knox as we sort of go on. In terms of his character and attributes, Thomas McCree said that Knox, who's his 19th century biographer, said Knox possessed strong natural talents. That although he didn't have access to the very finest education when he was younger, he surmounted this disadvantage, and he learned Latin while he was on the continent, so not as a young man. I guess he could be a model for some of his homeschooling parents. I guess Bruce learned Latin when he was an adult, didn't he? Well, there you go. I guess it's possible. Even in this century. He was very zealous for his faith. He was an excellent preacher. He was loathed by the licentious and profane. He got along very well with his brethren in the ministry. He was occasionally subject to, quote, depression. Sometimes confessed and begged forgiveness for being churlish. His zeal occasionally led him to use intemperate language. And, quote, his inflexible adherence to his opinions inclined to obstinacy. And his independence of mind occasionally assumed the appearance of haughtiness and disdain. Right, and we might also note that he had a pretty good sense of humor. If you didn't read too much of his writings in this review, but in the last class we read some of his writings, and some of them were pretty funny. Let's see, McCree also noted that God had fitted Knox for the task at hand. Says, to those who complain that they are disappointed in not finding in our national reformer courteous manners and a winning address, we may say in the language of our Lord to the Jews concerning the Baptist, what went ye out into the wilderness for to see? A man clothed in soft raiment? Behold, they which are gorgeously apparelled and live delicately are in kings' courts. But what went ye out for to see? A prophet? Yea, I say unto you, and more than a prophet. Disaffection to the work often lurks under cavils against the instruments by which it is carried on. And had Knox been softer and more yielding in his temper, he would have been pronounced unfit for his office by the very persons who now censure his harshness and severity. But wisdom is justified of all our children. Before the Reformation, superstition, shielded by ignorance and armed with power, governed with gigantic sway. Men of mild spirits and of gentle manner would have been as unfit for taking the field against this enemy as a dwarf or a child for encountering a giant. Okay, Knox's treatment history varies widely. I think mentioned that the Roman Catholic writers and also partisans of Mary, Queen of Scots, often heaped quite a bit of abuse upon his character. And that still holds true to some degree today, but I found a couple very interesting observations by, say, recent secular biography, Jasper Ridley, who saw Knox primarily as a successful revolutionary. He says, Knox is one of the most ruthless and successful revolutionary leaders in history. He was more ruthless, at least in theory, than any revolutionary of more recent times. But Knox and his Puritans are the only modern revolutionaries who proclaimed that it was sinful not to kill their enemies. Ridley attributes the fact that the Protestant Reformation in Scotland became Presbyterian rather than Anglican to Knox. Knox is one of the most important theorists of modern times. His importance has been overlooked because of the language in which he expressed his ideas. But when Knox wrote about the punishments inflicted on Pharaoh's soldiers for their docile compliance with orders, and the zeal of Jehu in killing wicked kings, he was putting forward ideas that were far more important for the future than the politio-legal theories of government of Bodine and Sir Thomas Smith and the intellectuals of his age. Only Buchanan can equal Knox in importance. This duty of the individual to resist evil rulers was taken up by the English Puritans, partly through Milton's tracts. And through Milton, Knox influenced by example, if not by doctrine, the men of 1776 and 1789, whose outlook has shaped all subsequent political thought and action. All right, so 1776 would be the American Revolution, 1789 would be the French Revolution, which I'm a bit dubious about, but he does say whose outlook has shaped all subsequent, if not by doctrine. So, you know, perhaps, I don't know, maybe they took some inspiration from it. Another great quote here is, he was speaking of how the duty of obedience to kings was cracked by Knox. And because of this, Knox, and then despite his intolerance, his dogmatic adherence to every word of Scripture and the tyranny of church sessions, was a great contributor to the struggle for human freedom. He taught the people they had a duty to fight for the right, irrespective of national allegiance and the orders of their governments. Modern democracy is grounded upon this principle, which Knox deduced from the text of Exodus and the Book of Kings. And, of course, I would say not despite, but because of it. Okay, James the Sixth was, at the end of 1572, was 6 years old. He received a classical and Calvinist education under the tutelage of George Buchanan. We spent some more time last time. We won't go over any stories from James's youth, but unfortunately, in the end, his education had rather the opposite effect intended. I mean, he turned out to be very bright, but also very profligate. He's a prodigy. He impressed a lot of people with his learning at a very young age, but he turned that to wicked ends. I'm not sure. I guess I've forgotten the sequence of events here exactly and what happened to the Earl of Mar. I think he may have just died naturally. I think he might be the one. But about the same day that Knox died, the Earl of Morton, James Douglas, became regent. And as described by Maurice Lee, he was a man of high political skill and no morals, whatever. And shortly after becoming regent, he forced the surrender of the castle in Edinburgh held by the Queen's Party. And that pretty much ended the struggle between the Queen's Party and the King's Party. Didn't end the struggle between the church and the state. With Knox gone, Morton apparently felt free to bend the church to his will. He corresponded closely with Elizabeth, and at least one Scottish historian thinks that Morton was trying to follow Elizabeth's example in making the church more like the Anglican church so he could control the bishops, till it should become as prolific and as accommodating as that of England. Let's see. But not content with the Tolchin bishops, he endeavored further to impoverish the church so he might thereby both enrich himself, a matter which he never neglected, and at the same time induce its poverty, if not its will, to consent to the pernicious measures. He contrived to draw into his own hands the thirds of the benefices, offering more sure and ready payment to the ministers than had been made previously by their own collectors, promising to make the stipend of each minister